I'm up on the tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. My guest today is novelist, lawyer, and all-around great guy, Michael Nava. And he's going to talk about his latest book called The City of Palaces. This guy has written 9 novels. And if that is not extraordinary in itself, he has written 9 novels as he was a full-time lawyer, which he still is. And he spends all his days writing amicus briefs, you know, a brilliant man. And Nancy Lechuga is going to share a poem by John Ashbery. Stick around. It's going to be a great show. And one of the things that I was struck with when I was reading Michael's novel called City of Palaces, it's set in Mexico City before the revolution, but it made me think about cities. It made me think about Mexico City. I tend to travel a lot. And what I love to do is I love to enter into cities. And I've done this in Mexico City many, many times. I'll just go into the city. I remember the first time I had never been to Mexico City in my life. I was very awed and intimidated by how big it was. I remember flying over the city and it just went on for miles and miles and miles and miles. Just these buildings and just sprawling urban area. And when the plane landed, I thought, well, what am I going to do now? I didn't have any hotel reservations. I just knew I was going to be there for about a month. And so I just got my suitcase and I took a bus to the Zona Rosa and I just started walking around and then I found a hotel. And I do this a lot. I did this with Havana, Cuba. First time I went to Havana, I had no idea where I was going to stay. I just kind of went there. First time I went to Marseille, France. First time I went to Warsaw. And I mean, I'm getting a little older now, so I tend to make reservations at a hotel for the first couple of nights at least. But one of the things I love doing when I enter into a new city is feeling the energy of a city. And we all know that every city has its own kind of energy. And we are either repelled by the energy or we feel comfortable there. That's why we can walk into New York City, for example, and feel immediately we feel comfortable there. Or it's opposite. Los Angeles, I spent a lot of time in Los Angeles. Not everybody likes the energy of Los Angeles. But if you do like it, you can maneuver around that city. And this is going to sound a little strange, but I know this to be true, at least it is for me. If you go into a city and you feel the energy and you can, in a sense, submit yourself to that energy, you can kind of walk and go where the city leads you, and it reveals itself in amazing ways. I don't like to go into a city with a list of things to do, like I want to see this, I want to see that. Rather, I like to go and just kind of like follow the city, you know, turn here, turn there, and the city reveals itself in amazing ways. I remember the first time I was walking through Paris, I saw probably all those landmarks that one should see when they're in Paris, but I discovered them instead of took a cab to get to them or had them on my itinerary. I'd be walking down this little narrow street with lined with buildings from the 1600s. And then suddenly there's this incredible, beautiful building that I, you know, I'm just so awed by it. And I think, my God, what is that? And it ends up being Notre Dame or something like that, right? And I love cities. I think cities are great. I think El Paso has some good energy. Los Angeles, I love Paris, I love Buenos Aires, one of the most magical cities in the world for me. When I got there, immediately I felt I was at home and I started walking. I remember the first time I arrived there, it was at 2 a.m. and I just got out of my hotel and just started walking until the sun came up, and it was incredible. So that's what his novel evoked for me. It evoked cities and the energy that we have from them. Looking forward to talking to Michael Nava, brilliant lawyer, brilliant novelist. Stick around, and we'll be right back. Michael Nava is a third-generation Californian of Mexican descent. He is the grandson of immigrants and was born in Sacramento, California. He was the first person, just like me, in his family to attend college, and he has a BA in history and a law degree from Stanford University. He is most famously known for his Henry Rios mystery novels, which are essentially these novels about a gay lawyer in L.A., and it's kind of the noir type of aesthetic. But his latest book is called The City of Palaces, and it's takes place right before the Mexican Revolution in Mexico City, and we're going to talk to him about that today. Michael Nava, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you, Daniel. Great to be here.
Now, you're a writer with eight novels, at least eight novels. Maybe there's even more. I lost count somewhere along the line. But you have a law degree from Stanford, and you know that's pretty impressive. A law degree from Stanford? How did that happen?
Well, when I graduated from college, I graduated with a degree in history, and I spent most of my 4 years in college smoking pot and writing poetry. So I decided, and I graduated in the middle of a recession. I decided, I don't think I can make a living writing poetry.
Or smoking pot, for that matter.
Or smoking pot. So I looked around at what I could do with this degree, and I thought, like so many other humanities majors, oh, law school. So, but I wasn't all that committed, so I only applied to three schools. I thought, if I don't get into one of these three schools, then, you know, it's a sign from the Virgen that I'm not supposed to be a lawyer. So I applied to Stanford, Harvard, and Berkeley. And Stanford accepted me right away.
Wow.
And Harvard put me on a wait list, and Bolt turned me down, which is why I have, you know, a lasting resentment against Berkeley. So that's how I ended up in law school, really. Truth be told, it was because I didn't have enough science for med school.
And you got a letter of recommendation from the Virgin herself. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I guess she wanted me to be a lawyer. And I have to say, as casually as I entered into the legal profession, you know, I've had a really wonderful and interesting career.
What kind of lawyer did you start off with, and where are you now? And then this is the third question to it. If you don't remember it, I'll get to it again. How the heck do you find time to write a novel?
Well, you know, in law school, I worked at private firms for the 2 summers between my second and third year classes, and before my second and third years, and I realized there was just no way as a queer Latino boy that I could survive in those all-male, upper-middle-class, white, elite echelons. Mm-hmm. So I thought, I can't do this. And so I went into public service. My first job out of law school was as a prosecutor in Los Angeles.
Oh, wow. That must have been fascinating.
Oh, it was wonderful. And it's actually where I got a lot of material for the Rios books, including his name, came from all that experience. So, and from there, I did go to a private firm for a couple of years. I learned a lot. I didn't really like, again, I could not adjust to the expectations that firms have of their attorneys in terms of the hours you put in and just sort of the social reality. So I went to work for an African-American appellate judge in Los Angeles, and I spent the last 25 years as an appellate lawyer, mostly working for the California courts, and currently I work at the California Supreme Court. That's how I've already forgotten the second question.
That's okay, because I have a follow-up question now.
Sure.
You've been a lawyer, you've been working, and it sounds like your career is going in wonderful directions. I mean, what you're doing now. Well, tell us what you're doing now, and then I'll ask the question.
So I'm a staff attorney for the judges, and basically I write the preliminary drafts of their opinions. For people who are not familiar with the appellate process, when you hear about the United States Supreme Court issued an opinion in such and such a case, the opinion is a written document that sets forth what the law is, and those opinions are generally written by, you know, staff lawyers in collaboration with the justices. So that's what I do. I write these draft opinions, and I work with the judge, and then ultimately it's issued and becomes part of the law of the state of California.
Wow, that sounds like quite a, you know, a job where you actually have to think and work. How do you do that, yet you have time to write more novels than I've ever written in my life, and I'm, you know, more of a full-time writer with, you know, who teaches occasionally?
I tell people I have a Mexican work ethic because, you know, I came from laboring people, from working class people.
Right.
The men in my family, they work construction and in the canneries. So I'm just acclimated to hard work. And the other part of it is, you know, I mean, I'm not writing all the time. I take time off between novels. But when I am writing a novel, I just treat it like another job, which means I have a set period of time when this is what I do. And it's always the same time every day. And, you know, I don't have the luxury of waiting around for inspiration or just until I feel like it. I mean, this is like, yeah, this is my time to write, and I'm going to write.
We're talking to Michael Nava, whose latest book is called The City of Palaces, and we're going to get to that book in a second. But first, I want to talk a little bit about the Henry Rios novels, because maybe our listeners aren't aware of them. But this is a series of mystery novels about a gay Latino lawyer, and you've written how many of them?
So there were seven in the series that were published between 1986 and 2000 when I wrote the last one.
You're like the John Grisham of the gay Chicano John Grisham.
I had a sort of more serious intention, I think, in writing these books than maybe John Grisham did.
Absolutely, because you can't really classify your stuff as pop fiction. It's not, even though there's a lot of plot, the fact is your fiction, and this is what I think marks good literary fiction, your fiction is driven by character and character need. Plot doesn't happen to them. They create plot based on their own perceptions.
Well, yes, that's true. And, you know, I never set out to be a mystery writer, but I deliberately chose the vehicle because what I wanted to write about was the experience of being an outsider, you know, specifically, you know, a gay man, a Latino guy, and the American noir novel. It really lends itself to that because, you know, in the works of people like Raymond Chandler, for example, your PI, he stands out of society. He's kind of looked on with contempt by society, and yet he's the one that they call upon to, you know, do their dirty work. Mm-hmm. And to me, that perfectly described the situation of a gay man in a straight society.
That's so nice.
It was because it's an outsider form, and I was not the only, you know, person to realize this. I mean, in the 80s and 90s, you had like Walter Mosley, Sarah Paretsky, Lucha Corpi, all of these, you know, a feminist writer, a Latina writer, an African-American writer who made the same discovery I did, that the vehicle of the mystery is a very interesting way to explore issues of race and social justice and gender.
You write on your webpage, you have a webpage, MichaelNavaWriter.com, you write that you both began writing and realized you were gay at 12 years old. Very young, to realize and accept, and also that you began writing. What's the connection between those two? Is there?
Well, I mean, there is. 12 is puberty, so it wasn't really that unusual. I mean, I began to notice that, you know, the boys who I knew were starting to talk about their feelings for girls, and I thought, oh, I'm having the same feelings for you. But, I mean, this is 1966.
Wow.
So, obviously, there was no safe place for me to express this, so I turned to writing. I wrote in an essay that, you know, one reason I think I'm a writer is I'm filled with the words I could never express when I was a child.
Right. Let's talk about City of Palaces. This is quite different from the Henry Rios novels, isn't it?
It is in sort of every aspect except the underlying theme, which is still, I'm still writing about outsiders and issues of social justice and those themes which have preoccupied me since I was a child.
Tell us a little bit about the novel, how it came about, and it takes place in Mexico City, you know, before the revolution in 1910. There must have been an incredible amount of research involved in this.
Well, the idea for what became, this is the first of three or four books, I haven't quite decided yet, but the idea came to me around 1995, and that's when the research started, and the research is ongoing, so it's been almost 20 years now. So my great-grandparents came up from Mexico during the revolution. They ended up in Sacramento. They were from the state of Guanajuato, and they had to leave because that was the scene of some of the heaviest fighting during the war. And yet I knew almost nothing about the revolution. It's as if, you know, an Irish-American knew nothing about the potato famine, or or a Jewish-American knew nothing about the pogroms that led his Russian ancestors to come here. And so one of my goals in writing The City of Palaces is it's to recover that history for us Chicanos whose ancestors came here, because a million Mexicans emigrated. It was the first great wave of Mexican immigration. There were a million Mexicans came to this country from 1910 to 1928 as war refugees, basically. Mm-hmm. So I want to recover part of that history for us, and I also wanted to educate, you know, white readers who think that the Cinco de Mayo is Mexican Independence Day, that there is a rich, beautiful, and magnificent culture and history south of the border. You know, we're not just a simple race of gardeners and maids.
Right.
And so it's the fall of the Diaz dictatorship as seen through the eyes of this this family, this upper middle class family, and their child. And it covers, you know, the tumultuous events from Diaz's fall, Madero's election, and the coup that overthrew Madero, and then the civil war that broke out. And it's interesting, as I was writing about the collapse of the Diaz dictatorship, he'd been dictator for 40 years, about the mobs gathering in the Zocalo demanding his resignation, I was watching on TV the Egyptians in Tahrir Square, you know, demanding the resignation of their former president. And I thought, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. But I think it has that kind of timeliness.
Right. You're a lawyer. You've been a lawyer for many years. I imagine there's... Was there a lot of research involved in this novel, City of Palaces?
It's tremendous research, and it is. I mean, I've always been a history nerd. I graduated with a degree in history. And yes, in fact, that's what I do at the court, is I spend my days researching, thinking, and writing. So
wow.
It wasn't that hard. But, you know, I had to recreate the world of Mexico City for myself before I could create it for the reader. And I had to know, I tell people 90% of the research doesn't appear in the pages, but it was necessary for me to know it so that I could write with confidence.
Right, right. And then there's that old, that iceberg effect, right? What the reader sees is just the tip, but there's a big, giant glob of ice underneath what they're not seeing.
Right. And I mean, one example I use is, you know, I had to learn, for example, that in the late 19th, early 20th century, you know, men didn't have zippers. They had buttons on their trousers because zippers hadn't been invented.
Oh, wow. That's an interesting detail, yeah.
And they didn't wear wristwatches because wristwatches were considered effeminate. That's why they wore pocket watches. Now, neither of those details makes it into the novel, but in order for me to imagine the male characters in the book, I had to see them as men with heavy pocket watches and buttons on their trousers.
It sounds like you can absorb yourself in research or in the imaginative world where you're in or whatever you're doing, and that's a tremendous gift and talent. And thanks for sharing it with our listeners. We're talking
sure.
to Michael Nava, and his latest book is The City of Palaces. Check it out. Michael, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Pleasure talking to you, Daniel.
My name is Nancy Lechuga, and I'm a local poet. And today I will be reading a poem by John Ashbery titled Myrtle. How funny your name would be if you could follow it back to where the first person thought of saying it. Naming himself that, or maybe some other person's thought of it and named that person. It would be like following a river to its source, which would be impossible. Rivers have no source. They just automatically appear at a place where they get wider. And soon a real river comes along with fish and debris, regal as you please. And someone has already given it a name, Saint Benno. Saints are popular for this purpose, or some other name, the name of his long-lost girlfriend, who comes at long last to impersonate that river on a stage, her voice clanking like it's sped, her clothing of sand and pasted paper, a piece of real technology, while all along she is thinking, I can do what I want to do, but I want to stay here. That was Myrtle by John Ashbery.
Hi, this is Marisol Baca, living in Fresno, California, and I teach composition in Fresno at Fresno City College. I've been writing for quite some time. I went to school in Ithaca, New York, got my MFA in creative writing. I pretty much spend most of my time teaching and writing and hanging out with my dogs and my wonderful fiancé. The poetic license that I'm doing today is a story about a remembered place, which is the kitchen in my grandmother's and grandfather's house in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where I grew up. This is closely linked to a lot of the feelings and the ideas that come out in my writing right now and are directly linked to the new book that I've just finished writing, which is called Revelado. And it's about growing up in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and also growing up in Fresno, California, where I am now, and the connection between the two and the landscape and the people. What I remember about my grandmother is the kitchen in her old house in Alameda, a section of Albuquerque we called the Valley in New Mexico. My grandmother, Grandma Lily, that's what I call her, that was her place, the kitchen, built by my grandfather like the rest of the house, and all white, painted. It was small to think of now, and about the size of my own kitchen. It was not filled with knickknacks. It was cool and clean and had the acidic smell of green and red chili and thick garlic. There wasn't much else to that smell. It was a functional smell, the kind of lingering smell that was of food, regular as the sunrise, and coated the room. Like I said, the kitchen was small. There was a doorway that led to the rest of the open house and a heavy screen door that led out to the wine room, the garage, and the outside, where there was mostly desert. It had a white ceramic sink and white ceramic tiles and white walls and a small ledge above the sink and a potted plant. From the window, you could see the dust and desert of that sun-drenched place outside that one might call a backyard. The refrigerator was old. It was a relic. It had the kind of metal handles that warned anyone who might want to open it needlessly. Later, it was a new refrigerator. The white eggshell exterior glowed whiter, even in the white of the room, and a gas stove. This was where the cast iron plate was. And for a time, my grandmother rolled out tortillas and placed them out so that the rounded seal cooked right through onto the tortilla. And the kitchen table, the one I have currently in my 1950s-built home, is strangely the exact copy of it. I acquired mine by providence. When I was poor and couldn't afford one, I got my sister's, probably found at an estate sale or yard sale in the 80s. It's got a white speckled laminate on top, and the steel legs bow out femininely. It has a laminate that scallops under the main tabletop, adding to the feminine look. It's small and sturdy and was placed against the wall in the kitchen. It was placed in a way that made it a mere extension of the wall, cream and white and spotted and always cool to the touch. There was an old meat grinder on the edge, clamped down like a vise. On special occasions, my grandmother would allow me to place frozen pieces of pork in the grinder. I was immensely interested in parts of the kitchen, and I was also a child, that is, easily distracted, and I wish I had paid even more attention. A house like this has areas of interest that a young child would take advantage of in discovering. My great-grandmother, Manuelita, used to live with my grandparents, and she slept in a far room on the side that I would visit to get lavender candies and look at the crocheted blankets on the big brass bed and the dark wooden dresser that my grandpa made. After my great-grandmother died, I was too scared to go into the room, but the idea of it far away at the end of the hallway kept me enthralled. So I was only in the kitchen late at night looking for where my grandmother put the moon pies and licorice. But I'm getting away from the topic. This is why poetry is so important to me. It's always the column or rope that ties me in. When I become so engrossed in a tangent, it says, go back. There is still something to be said about the kitchen. Go back. The kitchen table was where the preparation took place. Although I never remember my grandmother peeling garlic, I know she did, or crack an egg. How did I miss this? The things I remember are what a spoiled child remembers, the carne adobada, She pulled out hot from the oven the plate of tortillas already plated, the butter melting on them, the beans, the way we eat them, in a bowl mixed with red chili, and then assembling at the table or sitting at the dining table or standing somewhere in between. My grandmother had it good. The men, her sons, were there at lunch to eat and talk with my grandfather, to check in on her every day and to tell her how they loved her food. My grandfather, who is the local barber, would be there for lunch around the corner from the barbershop and angling for the wine room. Yes, we had a room cut out into the dirt that housed large glass canisters of wine that my grandfather would make every year. The children, my cousins, and I would have already eaten, but the men would just be digging in. They filled plates with red chili and beans and fried eggs. These were men that smiled long. It's a Garcia thing to have this kind of smile. That may not mean anything outside of a family, but we all have a side of the family which wears smiles like mountain caps, and sides of the family that are tall and brooding and think about mistakes and death. That would be the other side of the family. This family was Valley family. They worked in the sun. They worked with their hands. They drank deeply, and they picked fights a lot, but they smiled too. But the kitchen table was left to preparation and lunch meals and meeting long and drinking quince wine from mason jars. As Joy Harjo puts it in her poem so plainly, our dreams drink coffee with us as they put their arms around our children. They laugh with us at our poor, falling down selves, and as we put ourselves back together once again at the table. The kitchen table was a ghost story filled with the movement around it and the blur of time. The kitchen table was the sentineled griffin in white, always leading out and away to other backyards, to the wine room and its drunken debauchery. The kitchen table was where the aunts and mothers assembled the sugar and cinnamon for bizcochitos and peeled and chopped garlic and peeled the membrane of the chili from its waxy and roasted skin. It was where we were forced to get on our knees one night to pray for our drunken fathers and uncles singing and fighting in the clay-worn room, dug into the ground. That night, the kitchen was scrubbed clean by my aunts and mothers. And so I did see some things when I peeked in from my childhood to see what happens when adults must eat and tender their lives together. Harjo also says, the world begins at a kitchen table. No matter what, we must eat to live. And I would add to that, it's about the other hunger. Yes, the hunger that creates and builds a kitchen, to house a kitchen table, to feed the sons and to nourish the children, to fill the child's mind of memory and the life with substance and the smell of food already prepared and eaten and put away and forgotten in the mind of the stomach. The hunger that doesn't forget the woman who made it hers and used it and cleaned it and made it larger than what it was. For Words on a Wire, I am Marisol Baca.
I'd like to thank Michael Nava for joining us. That was a fascinating conversation, Michael, and I can't wait for your next book just so we can have you on the show again. And I'd also like to thank our own Nancy Lechuga for sharing another poem of the week. I like having Nancy read the poems because, well, quite frankly, her voice is a lot better than mine. And I'm Daniel Chacon. Join me next week for another edition of Words on a Wire. And don't forget, the next book you read may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope.